The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and frankly, it's a miracle of technology I'm here because I got the second to last flight out of the east coast of the USA before Hurricane Sandy hit the seaboard. In fact, the US is a theme of today's podcast, a pot of two halves, as our producer Jason described it. In the first half, we'll spill the beans on the latest announcements that have made it out of the US despite the disruptive weather system. And in the second half, we'll be playing politics. First, speaking with Alec Ross, Hillary Clinton's special advisor on innovation, who'll tell us about the U.S.'s 21st century statecraft and what it means for the next administration. Finally, we'll speak with Kevin Anderson, who covered the U.S. presidential election for The Guardian in 2008, about the American presidential race. I'm joined in the studio by Charles Arthur. Welcome, Charles.
Well, hello.
Well, hello. Howdy, as they say.
Indeed.
Over there. And keep listening to the rest of you from Tech Weekly from The Guardian. So, Charles, there have been quite a few announcements in the run-up to the holiday season. First up, Windows 8. That one managed to get through the storm.
Well, yeah, the storm was only just sort of gathering somewhere off in the Caribbean at the time. So, yes, Microsoft has now formally launched Windows 8, which is the very latest version of its PC, though now also tablet operating system. And it also launched its own product, the Surface, with Windows RT, which is the version of Windows that runs on ARM-based chips. That is the ARM architecture from the UK. Although Windows 8, which is distinct from Windows RT, they're very similar, but they're not exactly the same, is available on your good old Intel chips.
And, Charles, like I need some kind of infographic, you know, to distinguish all of these different Windows products.
It is complicated. The Surface runs Windows RT. So this means that you can only get apps which have gone through the Microsoft Store, which have been written and targeted specifically for Windows RT, and the only Microsoft apps that are on it that you may have heard of before are all the Office apps. There's a version of Office which is on the Surface. However, the early testers, you know, people who've sort of rushed out to the mall and bought the Surface in the US, we haven't yet seen them in the UK, have been saying there's sort of various bugs with the Office. You can update it. It does improve, but Steve Sinofsky himself even went onto one of the threads on Hacker News and said, yes, we know about this. It's going to be fixed. So it's been a bit of a 1.0 launch when it comes to the software, though, you know, people have praised the Surface's hardware. Personally, I don't think it's going to be a huge seller just because I don't think Microsoft is going to have made that many of them.
Well, it's interesting. When I was in the States last week, and the announcement, I believe, was last Thursday, in Washington, D.C., where I happened to be at that time, there were Surface kiosks in malls everywhere. So people were actually getting their hands on Surfaces and on the operating system themselves. And, you know, there were throngs who were literally crowding the people who were demoing it. So it looks like it might be something that could kick off in that market.
It might, but like I say, I'm not sure that Microsoft is actually going to have made that many of them because, you know, the sort of supply chain issues that you really have to talk about if you're really going to be getting into the multiple millions are actually pretty acute. And the fact that Microsoft has been having trouble in the UK with deliveries, dispatches, suggests to me that they're encountering all the sort of supply chain issues that, you know, anyone who tries to get into being a PC OEM encounters. And most of them have, you know, had years to work the bugs out. Microsoft has, you know, they've been good with Xboxes, but delivering Xboxes to retailers is not the same as delivering Surfaces to individuals. And all the processing and the, you know, like I say, the supply chain issues, the infrastructure that's needed there is a lot more complicated than people might think.
Let's move to Windows 8. I understand that it was actually not a very interesting launch, that we already knew most of everything that was part of the announcement already.
As is Microsoft's way, because it has, you know, because half of its customers, half of the people who buy PCs every quarter, roughly, are businesses. You know, they have to tell them what's happening a long way in advance so that they can plan, so they can figure out what they're going to do, so that they can, if they need to, rewrite software to run on the new OS. And yes, we've been hearing about Windows 8 for absolutely ages. You know, the sort of the tiled Metro interface. They're not calling it Metro, but we're going to call it Metro. What the hell?
It was originally called Metro, wasn't it?
It was originally called,
exactly.
And then Metro AG in Germany said, "No, this is our trademark." And Microsoft, you know, because they're very small and they're a little tech startup, you know, you got to understand.
Charles, I think you should do the podcast in the German accent for the rest of the year.
Perhaps Jeremy Clarkson doing a German accent.
Yes, exactly.
And then he said to him,
other accents are available. Anyway, so
with a very bad accent.
indeed. I don't think that'll get us too many followers. Very popular. But anyway,
we've been seeing it for absolutely ages. You know, I had a hands-on back in June or so. I was lent a Samsung tablet, which was running the release to manufacture version and, you know, the consumer preview, and then the release to manufacture version. And you know, it's an interesting take on what an operating system should be, especially for a world where, as Microsoft thinks it's going to be, you have tablets vying with PCs as a main productivity thing. It's interesting that Google and Apple are saying tablets are separate. You know, they live in a class with smartphones. Tablet is this big smartphone. Whereas Microsoft is saying tablets, PCs, they're all the same thing, really. You can argue that there's actually a financial reason for that, because you know, a Windows license is worth much more to Microsoft than a Windows phone license. So if it was to sell Windows phone licenses for tablets, it would get far less money.
I see friends, family, others using their tablets with, you know, with keyboards, mm-hmm. and literally using them as they would a PC Lite or an Apple Mac Lite. So, you know, it actually seems more logical to me that that a tablet would be more like a computer device as opposed to a smartphone device.
That's true. The problem you then start to run into is, okay, so what should the specifications be? If you're going to price it like a tablet, then it's quite cheap, in which case the OEM doesn't have much room left after they've paid for the Windows license to actually make a profit. If you price it with Windows Phone as the license, then it's a lot easier to hit a profit, but Microsoft doesn't get as much money and they're unhappy. So one way or another, someone's going to be unhappy, which is sort of where Surface comes out of, which is Microsoft saying, okay, well, if no one else is going to do this, we'll do this. You know, it's a bit of a sort of a lesson for the other OEMs of, you know, really make something good. And, you know, there's been a lot of praise for the hardware.
Given what you were saying about Surface and before about the fact that it may not actually take off and they're having a bit of trouble with their supply, and what you're saying now about it kind of in some ways being a diluted third leg product, something over there in the corner, is Surface potentially Microsoft's playbook?
No, I think they're going to sell millions of them. But equally, I don't think it's the direction that they're looking to go down long term, because for that they really need all the OEM partners to get into it. And the trouble is that if Microsoft has started Surface off in one price, then where do the OEMs find value? What do they do? They're better at the supply chain issue, they're better at the distribution issue, but Microsoft is, you know, as far as we know, is selling this thing around cost or so, because those things are not that expensive, you know, unless hardware prices have come down dramatically. I mean, you just look around at the fact that people like Samsung have had trouble you know, making a tablet at the same sort of price as Apple. They're really the only ones who have. And that suggests that actually the engineering involved is pretty hard to do. You know, even if you take out that Apple's doing 30% margins and stuff, then it's just quite hard to do this profitably. And that's why a lot of the other companies are focusing on Windows 8, which is the Intel chip one, which they reckon they can do far better because it'll run all your old Windows software.
Tell me a bit about the tablet 10.1.
So this is where we switch to Google and what they're looking to do. So Google was on Monday planning to hold an event in New York where they were going to show off the new Nexus 4 phone made by LG and the tablet 10.1 made by Samsung. Oh dear, there was a big storm came along and blew the event away.
I flew over it last night. It's pretty damn big.
It's sort of like a fairy tale.
or a horror story, to be honest.
Just on Halloween time. Mm. So Yeah, the idea is that Google is looking to have Samsung make a Nexus tablet. Vic Gundotra, who is the head of mobile for Google, has been putting some pictures up on his Google Plus feed. He didn't actually say that it was the 10.1 million people looked at the data for the pictures. They found that that's what it was. No data yet on the pricing as we're recording this, and no data on when it's going to be released. The Nexus 4 phone made by LG, which has been famously unprofitable for years. These guys just can't make any money selling handsets. And it's quite intriguing, actually, that Google has gone to them to make the Nexus, you know, which is the reference design, when they have their own in-house handset manufacturer called Motorola. That seems rather strange.
And so why have they done this? And something actually happened recently. The Nexus specs were leaked. Or accidentally leaked?
Well, the Nexus specs have been sort of dribbling out all over the web for ages. So possibly this also tells Google that people within LG aren't that great at keeping secrets. I don't know. Or maybe it's the Google people who are bad at keeping secrets, because one of them managed to leave the phone behind in a bar in California. You know, sort of stop me if you've heard this one before.
Yes,
guy walks into a bar with a new prototype phone, walks out without it.
Mm.
How many times have we heard that?
Curious.
Yeah, there was Apple with the iPhone 4, and
exactly,
there was someone else with the iPhone 4S. Now Google as well. And Google, in the same sort of way, got very excited, sent people down to the bar to retrieve the phone. The person with the phone wasn't there. They got a little bit excited. They went to the police station. Eventually, they got the phone back with no more sort of alarms and excursions. But pretty much everything is known about this phone. You can't keep much of a secret in Android land. It seems a respectable enough phone. 4.7 inches, no upgradable storage inside it, so no SD card. And probably like all the Nexus models, you'll get the early version of, you know, the new version of Android, whenever that is. But equally, they don't sell in massive numbers. That's just how the Nexus ones are. The carriers give bigger support to other models.
And finally, Apple and Samsung. What is the latest on their altercation?
Well, they've been having a fight in the UK and also sort of in parallel in the German courts. This is quite apart from all the other lawsuits that are going between the two. Apple had a case in the UK High Court where it alleged that Samsung was infringing on its registered design for the iPad. The registered design is a bit like what is generally called trade dress. It's sort of how does the thing look? It's not how it functions, it's how it looks. And in July, His Honour Judge Colin Burse came up with the fabulously famous judgment in which he said that the Apple products looked cool and the Samsung gadgets did not, or the tablets did not look cool. The way in which he did this was he sort of did it from the perspective of a, quote, informed person, as he's required to do under the law.
Is he a hipster? Does he have a moustache and turned up jeans?
Possibly under the gown.
And check shirt.
But he required Apple to... So Samsung was sort of going, yay, we won, though they're saying we're not cool. That's not so cool. And Apple was
exactly
saying, yay, we're cool, but wait, we haven't won. So it was sort of, you know, a bit of the gift of the Magi for both of them. And His Honour Judge Burse said that Apple had to make this public, that Samsung had not infringed because it had been making so much noise previously about the assertion that it was. And Apple managed in the Court of Appeal to argue this down to simply announcing on its website that this was the case. Eventually on Friday it did do this with a tiny link, though this is what the appeal court judges said was fine. They said, yeah, that's okay, you can have just a link on the front page of your website. You have to look pretty hard for it. It says Samsung, Apple...
The findings, the results. Yeah.
And it's an acknowledgement. It's not an apology, because, again, the Court of Appeal and Judge Burse, neither of them said it had to be an apology. It's simply a sort of restatement of various of the facts. And Apple, in what you might call grudgingly, says that Samsung has not infringed on its European community registered design. Although equally it then points to a couple of other court cases, such as the famous US one, where it won $1 billion for infringing on some other Apple patents. Though notably in the US one, the jury didn't think that the Samsung Galaxy Tab was in any way an infringement of the form of the iPad.
Well, you can find out more on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Alec Ross helped Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton in the run-up to the presidential election in 2008, and so when she became Secretary of State, she hired him to head up her 21st Century Statecraft Initiative, a project that marries digital technology with good old-fashioned diplomacy. I met with Alec last week in Washington, D.C. to speak with him about the U.S.'s political agenda when it comes to the World Wide Web and how he convinces transitional governments that freedom of speech online is the pathway to the future. So first and foremost, I wanted to find out from you how much you thought, as somebody who represents the U.S. digitally, the web itself is a kind of manifestation of U.S. values.
That's a great question. I think that it is a manifestation of certain values that are closely associated with the United States, including openness, freedom, liberty, and other such things. But I don't think it maps one-to-one against the values of the United States.
Even though so much of it was built here and
a lot of the DNA of the internet is American. But what I see is, and this is something I've really seen take place over the last 2.5 years, is that as other societies become hyper-networked, they really adapt the internet, including platforms that are American platforms for their own purposes and in their own ways. So I think that more often than not, what the internet does is amplify existing sociologies on the ground, rather than bend people towards other sociologies.
Though at the same time, you have things like a kind of manifest destiny element, you know, it empowers individuals.
It does.
You know,
look,
all of
and
these
that's and so it's not a coincidence, for example, that the United States has been so assertive, for example, in the domain of internet freedom. You know, we're sitting here at the State Department. Hillary Clinton's our 67th Secretary of State. Our first Secretary of State was Thomas Jefferson, who said the only legitimate foundation for government is the will of its people, and to preserve its free expression should be our first order. So from America's first Secretary of State to our 67th Secretary of State, there's been a common value set. And, you know, much to the anger of a lot of our foreign interlocutors, this is something that for over 200 years we've pushed. The 21st century manifestation of that is the internet. You know, it is very much the way in which people exercise the values that the United States are associated with.
And that's a really interesting element of soft power that we're seeing, much more so than historically when it was very much a sort of transmission model. We mm-hmm. say, you do. Now it's a dynamic, but
it's interesting. It's interesting. It doesn't always map to our specific political goals, though. It's interesting. In a lot of countries where the United States is not particularly popular, our technology and our technologists are. This is a form of soft power in the same way in which blue jeans were for the United States and the Beatles were for the United Kingdom during the Cold War. But it doesn't always map to a set of specific political goals. So just because somebody loves the openness, somebody loves the tools that allow for openness, participation, and connection from the United States does not necessarily mean that they are suddenly going to agree entirely with the actions that we take in the Middle East. So it works generally in our favor, but not entirely.
So one of the things I'm particularly interested in at the minute is the ways that systems like Google and Facebook mm-hmm. are creating, or rather replicating, human values. Mm-hmm. And especially having grown up in the States and living in a Western democracy in the UK, mm-hmm. Things like, I can see things like relevance and value, you know, attributions of that. And that's sort of what Google is trying to pin down mm-hmm. for commercial purposes. Or Facebook is particularly interested in relationships and identity. And they
yes.
have both systems have a very clear idea of what they think those things are.
Yes.
So Facebook, for example, thinks identity needs to be authentic if mm-hmm. it's tied to your offline self, if it's tied to existing networks, and if it's tied to photographs. Mm-hmm. Google thinks that something is relevant and valuable if people like you, like that link, or if mm-hmm. it's something that's similar to stuff that you've already created. Mm-hmm. Now, those are sort of interesting ideological aspects of the software that do come out of this country. And I'm wondering what long-term you think a kind of global attitude towards these human values might be, because people are using these systems at a phenomenal rate.
I think that part of what it is doing is it's shifting norms among, I think the biggest impact is it's shifting norms and mindsets among people who are growing up digital around the world. So I think that the influence of the, let's call it the ideology behind the software, has less of an impact changing the minds and changing the attitudes of people 50 and above. What I do believe is that young people in Jakarta or Beirut or Johannesburg who are growing up digital are growing up with these values more baked into their worldview. It's interesting. I mean, especially when you think about how this maps against things like privacy, when you think about how it maps against ideas about hierarchy and a lack of acceptance of traditional hierarchies and other such things. I see things in common. I see a lot in common between people in Jakarta, Beirut, and Baltimore that maps against demographics. And so where I think that this is really taking root is among people who are growing up digital.
So some of the historical organizations, commercial organizations, mm-hmm. that state has put, perhaps not its weight behind, but certainly, you know, and again, not promoted, but mentioned, for mm-hmm. example, or worked with in yeah. the past, are systems like Google, are systems like Facebook.
Those are the ones that get all the attention,
obviously,
but honestly.
But then there's the smaller ones as well. So mm-hmm. there's, you know, there's people like Austin Heap who created.
That is a complete myth. So we've spent about $100 million on proxy and circumvention technologies and supported a large number of organizations. There's been some completely inaccurate reporting that we supported whatever it was called,
Haystack.
It's somebody reported it was taken for to be true. It's not true. So that's just false.
So how, though, do you identify which systems you're going to support? Because
we use the ones that are most prominent and most relevant in a given place. So in Japan, that can be Mixi. In Jordan, it can be Maktub. In Brazil, it can be an Orkutchi. It's important for us to not be deterministic about the platform or about the tool. It actually helps if it's not an American tool. You know, I'm occasionally accused of creating a military-industrial complex with America's Silicon Valley.
That's the 3D printing. That's another conversation.
So the simple fact of the matter is that part of the reason for that accusation is because of close personal ties with executives in these organizations. Those aren't relationships I'm going to apologize for, nor are they relationships that I think I should apologize for. However, it does actually create an incentive for us to work with local platforms that are less prone to that kind of accusations. For example, we did something with Secretary Clinton in Egypt. And we could have used Facebook. People, you know, Facebook is a widely used platform in Egypt. We chose to use Masrawi just because we didn't want to hear the accusation that we were manipulating the platform to exercise American platform. So it's important for us to not pick winners and losers, but to actually go where the people are.
Always. I mean, it would be difficult because
it's
something
to
turn around.
Yeah, and it's actually easier. And you know, look, the head of Twitter International, her immediate prior employer, was the State Department. Her immediate prior boss was me. The head of Google Ideas, immediate prior employer was the State Department. You know, close collaborator was me. So, you know, look, it's reasonable to draw these ties. But if anything, it creates the exact opposite incentive for us, which is to try to use tools that can't be accused of somehow being manipulated by us or overly associated with us.
Alec Ross, Hillary Clinton's special advisor for innovation at the U.S. Department of State. So joining us now on Skype is Kevin Anderson. And Kevin, formerly of this parish, The Guardian, you covered the 2008 U.S. presidential election. Thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Alex.
So, Kevin, tell me a little bit about what you did last time around, because it was quite extensive.
Well, last time, and I covered the two previous presidential elections for the BBC, so this is actually not covering this election is a little bit of an anomaly for me. But beginning in sort of September all the way up to Election Day, I covered the election really through the eyes of social media at the time. Met up with bloggers all across the United States as we traveled from Los Angeles to Washington to arrive on election day, and really sort of tried to get a grassroots view from people who were covering the election in their local areas on blogs, and we were live tweeting on the night of the election, which was quite a lot of fun. So, you know, it was really social media, and Facebook was just rising then. Twitter was definitely a force in terms of the coverage that we did. And the big story in 2008 was really Barack Obama's effective use of not just social media, but also, an incredibly effective website and even some early mobile apps to get out the vote.
So tell me what you view as the greatest difference in terms of the digital landscape in 2012.
Well, in 2012, I think it's just a given that the campaigns are going to be on social media, and you see a lot more of volume-based kind of views on who has more tweets, who has more YouTube videos. And I really think you need to dig one layer deeper and to see what's happening, what's going on with the election this time. I mean, I think they're one of the big tech trends we've got, of course, is big data. This idea that we now have more access to data, but we can also make more sense of it. And you can really see that. And for your listeners, a great book to read is Neal Stephenson's Interface. And in it, there's a character that's kind of a cross between Karl Rove and Hannibal Lecter. And that will give you nightmares for the next week.
Yeah. That, oh, God, you've just sent chills up and down my
exactly.
spine. Kevin.
And in it, this is kind of amazingly creepy, psychopathic character is involved in all of this micro-targeting, right? And so he's got this voter demographic of economic roadkill. And they've got about 15 different voter demographics. And if you look at like projects online, projects like the Patchwork Nation, you see those kind of, suburban, it was back in 2000 with soccer moms, and you see the different demographics roll out through. There is an estimation now that they're targeting 100 different micro groups in the electorate. And I think that is really the change that we really started to see this time around, is that the targeting has gotten so much more surgical. I mean, it's more like smart bombs for political campaigns.
And at the same time, though, we're also seeing the other side leveraging the network. So, the big story in 2008 was Obama's use and his team's use of the digital platform, as you said before. And that kind of blew the candidate McCain out of the water last time. But certainly this time around, we're starting to see more and more of those grassroots networks organizing themselves online from the Republican side. Do you think that's actually one of the reasons why Romney's campaign has been so effective?
Well, I want to challenge that slightly, because the first person to ever raise more than $1 million online, John McCain in 2000. So the Republicans have been online, but I think that the differences between online organizing and actually mirrors offline organizing as well. So the Democrats have always been much more about grassroots, get out the vote. I mean, even in this campaign, Romney's got 300 field offices versus Obama's 800. So that's a little bit of just kind of structurally how they do it differently. I think you're right, though. I mean, you do see a lot more. And this started, I'd say, a lot with the Tea Party movement. They were early, they had a very early embrace. And so you see on Twitter the hashtag, TCOT, Top Conservatives on Twitter. And that was already starting at a very nascent level 4 years ago. And I think it's really come into its own. So, I think conservatives have always been there. I think outside the parties, they have been even more boisterous and active. So, when you look at a lot of the conservative media in the United States, whether it's talk radio or Fox News or that kind of conservative media, they are very active use of social media. And I think that started to filter into some of the things that the Romney campaign is doing.
Just going back, Kevin, one thing you said, that there's all this targeting going on. How is that targeting done? I mean, I'm presuming this is not done through TV ads, because it'd be very hard to target a TV ad, because that's going to go out across multiple of these small demographics. So how is that done?
It's done in a lot of ways. And I think this is one of the areas where, I mean, even in the United States, we don't get coverage unless you're a Politico of the kind of ground war, which is where a lot of the kind of pushing and moving of voter sentiment happens. And a lot of that is direct mail, and it's also just knocking on doors. And so how that's happening is a couple of really great instances of it this year. I mean, the campaigns for a long time now have known, they'll know, you know, the FT had a great piece on big data, and they said they know that you're a Catholic voter, that you tend not to vote in school board elections, but you do in presidential elections. They know what kind of magazines you get, blah, blah, blah. And they kind of put piece together with a number of, basically, just think of it as politics as marketing. A number of those demographic things to sort of target that. Now, you know, you may get a piece of direct mail, or more likely than not, I mean, this year, the Obama campaign's mobile app, you can just pop in, it'll figure out where you're at, and it will tell you possible Democratic voters near you that you can go knock on their door. So
it's kind of like, you know, Grindr, but for voting.
Exactly. So, you know, walk down the street, there's a guy named Jack, you know, he's 29 years old, he's got 1.2 kids and a dog, and his wife's named Helen, and, you know, he voted Democrat last time.
And he likes lattes with the with wings.
Exactly, exactly.
So you can go have a coffee.
You know, in some ways, this is just a digital incarnation of things that they've always done. They would used to send you out with, like, a clipboard with some numbers and names and a little bit of detail. Now you just, you know, there's an app for that. So
but,
I think that's the other way. Now, there was
thing,
another bit of an anecdote that I saw kind of pass by me on social media, and that was... the Obama campaign has about 256 videos, At the time of the article that was written, there were 256 videos to Romney's sort of like 74 or 80, something like that. And there was a link that a reporter got about Jewish issues because he happens to be Jewish. So they're using YouTube not just as a, you know, a blast of a broadcast channel, but they're also using it just to host videos that they can then use to kind of target some of these demographic areas. So I mean, that's the kind of, Charles, that's the kind of way that they're getting into people's heads.
But it sounds like, I mean, the whole thing of you know, someone who's trying to recruit for the Obama campaign gets this app and it points them to someone, because it's getting people to go out and trying to encourage them to vote, trying to get them to take part in the democratic process. That's got to be actually a good thing, surely.
I think it's a good thing. The only thing I do tend to worry about this is, you know, I hope that the app registers that somebody's actually knocked on their door. Because the worst thing you can do is knock on somebody's door a half dozen times. And then that, you know, it may not mean that they'll change their vote, but it may turn them off from voting and just, you know, not. And I think the other issue along that line is voter fatigue. And I, you know, a lot of Americans have gotten pretty sophisticated filters to just drown most of this out, but it goes on for so long. I mean, you know, my parents about this time, if I even mention the elections, they just start shouting at me. So, you know, I think there is some level where, you know, especially this sprint in the last 2 weeks, you know, you do have the potential to sort of turn people off. I mean, I agree with you, Charles. I think it's great and to get people involved. And I guess this was one of the things that happened in 2008 and that was really revolutionary for the Obama campaign, because in 2004, you obviously on the Democratic side had Howard Dean, but they weren't necessarily able to translate that online enthusiasm into people voting. And
was it actually people voting? I think I'm wondering how much of a fallacy this is. Was it not people sending micropayments? Was it not people sending, you know, $10 here, $10 there, rather than actually getting out the vote? And in fact, it was the phone calls, and it was people knocking on the door, and it was the letters through the mailbox that actually got people, and the literally picking people up and haranguing them to the polling station that actually got people to vote versus getting
the
people
thing
to send money.
And the, you know, last time they had this great program called Camp Obama. So once you registered with the website, you would actually be invited to come out to basically organizing training. And this really reflected a lot of Obama's kind of community organizing background, and that it, you know, they said they weren't trying to put words in people's mouths. They were just trying to help them to tell their story better. I mean, you know, in a cynical way, you could say that it just helped them pitch a bit better. I think with Howard Dean's campaign, they realized that it wasn't just the online, you know, tapping in online enthusiasm. It was actually making sure that online enthusiasm, that you immediately gave someone a real world activity, something to do, something to kind of channel that enthusiasm. And I think, you know, this time, some of the issues in terms of Romney versus Obama is that, you know, he doesn't have that absolute, you know, that deep well of enthusiasm to tap. I don't think the enthusiasm gap is that wide, but, you know, there's definitely after the first debate, you've got Romney supporters who are fired up and just say, put me to work, and let me do something. So, and I don't think you had that before the first debate. So I think, you know, that Romney's ability to sort of use some of these techniques to tap into that enthusiasm probably helped him in this stretch.
So actually, when you're looking at what the digital technologies are being used for in this election, you know, the micro-targeting and to an extent the mobile apps, we're not seeing as much of a gear change, are we, between the last two elections? So what, or the last election and this one, so what do you think will happen given this almost kind of like a natural evolution of how people are using technologies? What do you think is going to be the next election digital phenomenon, the next zeitgeist that will be targeted and harnessed?
I can't even tell you what's going to happen in another week, much less what's going to happen in 4 years, but let me give a shot.
Yay. Thanks for that.
I think a lot of it is, you're right, there was a great quote from Ken Melman, who was Bush 2004, kind of the head of their campaign, saying, you know, we invented the engine in 2004 and, you know, the Obama campaign turned it into a race car. And so you're right that I think we're at this point of an evolutionary split. I think, you know, it's not rocket science to say that, you know, we saw a mobile app 4 years ago that was actually created not by the Obama campaign itself, but by an Obama supporter. This time it was created by the campaign. I think you'll see a lot more mobile apps. And I think that's one thing that's very interesting in this election. And one of the reasons why you see so much volatility in the polls is because you've got such a large group of people who are mobile phone only, cell phone only households. And so reaching those people often isn't calling up a landline, or, you know, it will be an evolution on mobile. It will be an evolution, a post PC evolution. And I think that's what we're really going to see. Mm. I think, you know, the social media revolution, I think we're now kind of into it's mainstream part of the hype cycle. It's not going to be anything new, but it's going to be some new kind of technology, probably around mobile, probably around some ability to, and I think we're going to see, the things that really turn the elections can be, you know, even just kind of these guerrilla videos. I mean, 4 years ago, it was the video on the Virginia Senate campaign. This time it was that video of Mitt Romney and the 47%. So you're going to see a lot more of that kind of viral video stuff, I would suppose. But again, probably not revolutionary, more just evolutionary.
Thank you very much, Kevin. We shall watch this with bated breath. That's it for this week. Thanks to Charles in the studio, Kevin Anderson down the line, and Jason Phipps, our producer. I'm Alex Kratowski. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.